Proverbs 22:6, bring up a child in the way that he should go, and even when he's old, he'll not depart from it. You know, many times we preachers have preached that to warn parents of the necessity of training children. And certainly that is a valid use of this verse. This morning I want to take a little different twist to it. I want to show what the wayward child does to the parents. And actually, I'd like to divide the lesson into three different areas. To start off by setting the scene of a grieving father, a wounded father, and then show the background as to how that came about. And then the last part, to give five suggestions that I hope will help those that are grieving over children that are prodigal in their lives. First of all, we find this scene. Israel is involved in a civil war. And someone has said the most uncivil of all wars is a civil war, whether it's brother against brother. David's own son, Absalom, had led a rebellion against him to take over the throne. And David is in the city of Mahanaim, where he fled from his son. There organized his army into three divisions, and then was going to lead them out, but they said, no, you stay here in the city where you're safe. You're worth more than 10,000 of us. And ever since that giant Ethiopian almost killed David, the men have been very reluctant to allow him to go out into the battle. And so David said, well, whatever you think is best. But he stood there at the gate as the army passed out. And when his commanders came, he said to them, deal gently with the young man Absalom for my sake. And so the armies went out. Well, I imagine there were daily runners that came back to give David a report. And he sat on a chair there, or a place that they had for him between the two gates. And there was a watchman on top of the roof there. And David would listen to those messages and messengers that came home with the report of the battle. And on this particular day, the watchman looked and said, we see a man running, and he's by himself. David said, good, he's bringing news of the war. And when the men got closer, they said, it's Ahimaaz. And David said, good, he's a good runner. You know, they had some that bear good news, some bad news. Ahimaaz was one to bring good news. And when he came up and he said, it's well, it's peace, we've won. But David's question was, is the young man Absalom safe? And whether or not Ahimaaz actually knew what had happened, I don't know. But he may have just been dodging telling David what had happened. He said, well, when I left, there's a group over and I don't know what it's all about. And then about that time, the watchman said, there's another runner running. And David said, step aside here. And here came the man, the second runner. And he came running up, and he either did not know the king's feelings or did not care, because he said, peace, all is well. David said, how's the young man Absalom? And he said, I would to God that every enemy of my lord the king, everyone that rises up against him, be as that young man this day. And David crumbled, heartbroken. And it said he slowly climbed the steps of the chamber above the gate, crying, oh, Absalom, Absalom, my son, would to God I died in your stead. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. Now, how did all of this come about? Let's go back maybe a decade before this time. It actually began when one of the sons of David, Amnon, thought he was madly in love with his half-sister, Tamar. But he couldn't find any way to get her private to himself. And he had a friend, quote friend, Jonadab, that said, look, you pretend to be sick, and then when the king comes to check on you, then you tell him what you want. And so Amnon pretended to be sick, and word came to David, and David came to visit him, and he said, what can I do for you? He said, well, send Tamar that she may bake some bread here in my own apartment. And so David, not suspecting anything, sent the virgin Tamar to Amnon. And when she came and she finished the bread, said, well, it's ready. And he said, well, bring it into my bedroom here and feed it to me. And then he said, all you others, get out. And when she came, he grabbed her, and she knew that he was going to try to force her. And she said, don't do this. Ask the king, he'll give me to you. But he wouldn't listen, and since he was stronger, he raped her. And then it says the hatred that he had for her was greater than the love that he had for her. He said, get her out. And she cried, no, this is worse than the first. Ask the king, he'll give me to be your wife. But he refused, said, get her out, told his servant, put her out and lock the door. And when poor Tamar went out, she tore that garment of many colors that the king had given to his virgin daughters. And then she headed to the house of her full brother, Absalom. Now, Absalom and Tamar had the same father and mother. And when she came, Absalom said, was this Amnon? She said, yes. He said, oh, and pretending like it's no big deal. He's a member of the family. Don't pay any attention to this. But she remained there in his house, grieving, alone the rest of her life. Well, while Absalom pretended not to care, that day he sealed the death of Amnon. He waited two whole years before he acted, but then he sheared the sheep, and after it was over, they had a big feast, and he told David, come with your attendants. And he knew David would not have time to come. Then he said, well, send Amnon and the king's sons. And finally, David relented and sent them. And then Absalom said to his servants, you wait until he's drunk, and then I'll give the signal, and don't hesitate, kill him. And so the time came, and he killed him. But Absalom knew he had to get out of the country. He had already made plans, apparently, to go to his maternal grandfather's country, which is Geshur, about 90 miles away. And so he fled there. And then he waited and waited and waited for his father to call him back. But David did not. Finally, Joab knew, knowing how David longed to have him every day, got with a woman, and they devised a way to bring him back. And David brought him back, but said, don't let him see my face. 2 years went by. And then finally, he relented and saw Absalom. I don't know what had been in Absalom's heart before that, but here's 5 years separated from David. And when he came back from Geshur, he was a different man. He then began to plot to take the kingdom. And he was very sharp. First of all, he had to be known. So he had 50 men to run in front of his chariot to announce Absalom is coming. And then he had long hair, and he made his cutting of his hair once a week sort of almost like a national holiday, because they would all weigh it, and I can imagine from these football games that there was betting going on as to how much Absalom's hair is going to weigh. Well, it weighed 200 shekels. That's a floating number there, the value of the shekels, but some think that it means 6 pounds of hair he had when he had his hair cut each year, but it grew back. Well, then he began to get up early in the morning, and people coming for judgment, Absalom would be there to meet them, and they would bow down. He said, no, stand up. I'm like one of you. And then they would say, he said, what's your case? And they would announce, and whatever it was, oh, Oh, that's a good case. If I were judge, I would see that you got justice, but unfortunately, there are not enough judges. And so he won the hearts of the people. Then when he had everything ready, and the signals to give for the men to join him in the final assault on David, he came to his father and said, "When I was in my exile, I promised the Lord if I ever got back home, I would go to Hebron and there offer sacrifices. And please let me go." David, not suspecting anything, let him go. And at the signal given, the men rose up from various parts of the country, joined Absalom, and they marched on Jerusalem. Well, then the people divided, some with Absalom, some with David. And David had his chief counselor, Ahithophel, that went with Absalom. And then there was Hushai, another of his wise men, wanted to go with him and said, "No, you go back and refute the judgment of Ahithophel." Well, Ahithophel said when he came in, "Take his concubines that he's not able to take with him, just his near family." He said, "Take his concubines, put a tent on the roof, and then violate them. That'll show that you're never going to be reunited with your father again. And then let me take the men tonight. And while he's tired and unsuspecting, I'll go and find him alone. We'll kill him. None of the others will be bothered. They will then come over to your side and we'll win the war." Well, Absalom said, "Okay, but let me see what Hushai has to say." And Hushai said, "Well, his advice is not good this time, because you know your father. You know he's a man of war, experienced in many battles. And he's not going to be sleeping with the men. He'll be off in another place. And when you attack the men, they're brave soldiers, and some of your soldiers are going to be killed. So the king will still be there, and word will go out that you've had a battle and you had losses in the battle, and the people are going to desert you." And Absalom said, "Well, that's right." But he said, "You wait till tomorrow, and we'll gather everybody together, and wherever he is, we'll go in and drag that city to the sea." But he took that advice. And then in the meantime, Hushai sent word to David, "Get over the Jordan. Don't delay tonight. Cross on over. Go to your place and get your army together." Well, David fled and said when he went across the Kidron Valley, he was barefoot and crying. And then many cursed him on the way along the way. But then it came the time for the scene that we saw at first, and when the word came back after the battle. Well, let me put one other thing in there. In the battle, Absalom, with that long hair, ran under a tamarind tree, got his head caught in the bushes, and pulled him off of his mule. There he was swinging by his hair in that tree, and the man saw him and told Joab, said, "Did you kill him? I'd given you so many pieces." "No, I didn't kill him. Everyone heard what the king told you. You gave me 100 pieces of silver, I wouldn't touch him." And so Absalom said, "Get out of the way." And he took 3 spears himself and put them in the heart of Absalom. And then he had 10 armor bearers that shot his body full of arrows. And he was taken down, thrown in the pit, covered with rocks. And then the news was sent back. He told one, he said, run, give David the news. And that's when Ahimaaz said, "Let me run too." No, you shouldn't run, because the king won't be happy with your news." "Well, I'll run anyway." And then he ran by way of the plain and outran the other. And then here's David. And you can imagine the sorrow that he felt. Think of the shame. Think of the anger even. And think of the feeling of having failed in one of life's most important jobs, that of rearing your children. And no doubt thinking of those days that maybe when he was out fighting wars, spreading his kingdom, he didn't have time for Absalom. Or then there's the danger of polygamy. He had 8 wives and at least 20 boys, and no way that he could get around to seeing all of them. You can see how Amnon had to pretend he was sick to even see his dad. And then there also, there was that sordid affair that David had with Bathsheba. And he killed her husband to try to hide the paternity of the child. But God said, you've done this thing in secret. I'm going to let all Israel know. And that, of course, included his family. And Absalom, with the knowledge of what David had done, could not easily be disciplined by his father. But here he is, brokenhearted, downcast. And how many times has that been repeated? You know, Longfellow has a beautiful song or poem related to that. He called the chamber over the gate. And I'm just going to read 3 stanzas from that. Is it so far from thee, thou canst no longer see in the chamber over the gate the old man desolate, weeping and wailing sore for his son who is no more, Absalom, my son. Somewhere at every hour, the watchman on the tower looks forth and sees the fleet approach of hurrying feet of messengers that bear the tidings of despair. Oh, Absalom, my son, that 'tis a common grief, bringeth but slight relief. Ours is the bitterest loss, ours is the heaviest cross, and forever the cry will be, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son. Okay, the deed is done. Your child is going astray. What do you do? First of all, realize that no one is perfect. Baseball players don't bat 1,000. Doctors don't. Lawyers don't. Preachers don't. None of us does. And if you can see where you failed, confess that to God. Get His forgiveness. And then put that part of it at rest. You know, David said, when I kept silence, my bones wasted away. My moisture was changed as the drought of summer. But I confess my sins unto thee, and thou forgavest the iniquity of my sins. Psalms 32. Okay, number 2. Realize that your child is a free moral agent, that he is accountable for what he does. You know, when God had the divine counsel on the last day of creation, everything else created, he said, let us make man in our own image. We assume he, the Son, the Holy Spirit are consulting together. And when God made man in his own image, I don't know what all that involves. But I do know it involves 2 things. Number 1, it gave man an immortal soul, made in the image of God, sharing the eternity of God. And then number 2, he gave men the power of choice and made him responsible for his choices. You know, all the lower animals operate on instinct. That old dog that turned over your garbage can because he was hungry was not a sinful dog. God gave him a hunger instinct, and then he gave him a good nose. And when hunger and the good nose came together and he smelled your garbage can, there it went. So he doesn't need to repent and apologize and pray God for forgiveness. He's not in that category. But man is. And when one sins, he is guilty for his sins. In Ezekiel 18:20, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. The son will not be responsible for the sins of the father, nor shall the father be responsible for the sins of the son. Man is responsible for himself. Well, how about Proverbs 22:6? We said in the very beginning that a proverb speaks of what is generally true, as shown by human experience. But if you say that it is an absolute, you'd have to accuse God of being a poor father. God created Adam and Eve. You know, here are some of the things that folks say why children go astray. There are some that said, well, they had bad heredity. Their genes that made them nervous and so forth. And this is true in some cases. But Adam and Eve didn't have bad heredity. They were perfect. Well, others say it's bad companionship. Well, they didn't have any companions. They were the only ones. So that didn't lead them astray. Someone say, well, it's poverty. Oh, Adam and Eve are not poor. They were put in a garden where they had everything beautiful to see, great to eat, the fruits. Well, maybe it's because they were neglected. Let me tell you, every afternoon and at the beginning of the two evenings, God came and communed with them. So they had God as their father, as their teacher. They had everything they could want. But when it came down, were they going to obey God or were they going to obey Satan? They chose Satan. And look what a mess they made of the world by their choice. And so we have the power of choice. And when we make that choice, we're responsible for it. And so it is with your child. If he goes astray, he is responsible for what has happened. But then number three, I want you to realize that in your sorrow, God is sorrowing also. And to tell you, when you hear some of the cries of God regarding Israel, it reminds you very much of a parent that has had a child to go astray. Listen in some of these verses or some of these statements from Hosea chapter 11, 1 through 8. Here God describes Israel, his wandering child. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. But they did not know that I healed them. How can I give thee up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, Israel? You can see God himself like a father. And then Jesus Christ, in Hebrews chapter 2, verses 9 and 11, it says that his brethren were flesh and blood, and he was made to be flesh and blood so he could be like his brethren. And so God's Son came, like we are, flesh and blood. And then in Hebrews 4:15, we have not a high priest who cannot be touched with the feelings of our infirmities, but one who in all points was tempted like as we, and yet without sin. So God understands, and when we sing that beautiful song, does Jesus care? Oh, yes, he cares. I know he cares. His heart is touched with my grief. That is so very, very true. Then number four is hard because it goes sort of against our nature. You know, we be secretive, private. We like to keep our own private things private. But this is not exactly God's way. In James 5:16, James says, confess your sins one to another and pray one for another that you may be healed. And so we are told to share with others these problems we have. Galatians 2:4, bear you one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. When you share your burdens, others can pray for you. when you share your burdens, there are others that are burdened just as you are. And to hear you confess yours can be of great encouragement for them to confess theirs. You know, this morning after Randy has finished his sermon, there's an opportunity for you to say, "Brethren, I need your prayers." And you'll find a beginning of a source of some relief. But one final thing. We want everything to be as it was. But if you have a prodigal child that comes home, things are not going to be the same. When my step-grandson was dying of brain cancer, he would send out a letter of his eyes feeling every time he could. In that, he had a statement that I had never heard before. Heard it many times since. He said, "I'm learning that I can't do many things that I once could do. And so now I'm having to adjust to a new normal." Let me tell you, when that wandering child comes home, you're going to have to adjust to a new normal. I know that the dirt of the pig pen can be washed off, even the odor of the pig pen. But it may take a long, long time for the squeals of those pigs to vanish from your child's ears, because they linger on and on. And your child, you're going to have to reach out to your child, and he's going to have to know that you want him back home. You know, some dear friends of mine not long ago had a daughter that did what they never dreamed she would do, nor those who knew the family dreamed she would do. And they were embarrassed. They were hurt. They were mad. They were heartbroken. In fact, the mother was so mad that she didn't want to have anything to do with her daughter for a while. But I have a friend who is closer to the family even than I am. And I kept asking him how the mother was doing. And finally he said that, she said, "I'm tired of casting stones. And so you're going to have to reach that stage. And you're going to have to realize that as much as you could wish it and pray for it, it will not be the same." Back during World War II or the end of World War II, and the of early years of the 50s, there was an orchestra that was led by Billy Rose out in Vegas that was very popular. But Billy Rose was also a writer, and he had a syndicated column called Pitching Horseshoes. And this was toward the end of the war, and he wrote many, many stories, and there was one that I'll never forget. He said that there's a couple waiting for their son. He was in the Pacific, the latter part of World War II. And finally, after two atomic bombs, the Japanese surrendered. And they waited eagerly to hear about their son. And then word came that he had been discharged. And as soon as he got back to the West Coast, he had called. They waited for that call. Then it finally came. And he said, "Mom, Dad, I'm back in the old USA. And they said, "Wonderful, wonderful. When can you come home?" And he said, "I'm going to get the first train that I can get to come home. And then he paused a minute and said, Mom, I have a buddy with me that was with me all during the war. I want to bring him with me. Oh, sure, we want to know anyone that you knew and fought with, and bring him by to stay a while. And he said, Mom, I've got to tell you, he's severely wounded. He has only one eye, one arm, and one leg. And there was a long pause. And then she said, bring him by. We'd like to have him for a week or two. And he said, Mom, you don't understand. I'm all that he has. And I want to take care of him the rest of my life. Long pause. And finally the mother said, you come on home and we'll talk about it. They hung up. The next morning, a green military car pulled up in front of their house, and two officers came to the door and identified themselves and asked if they were the mother of this corporal. And he said, the parents of this corporal, and said, yes. And he said, I'm sorry to tell you, your son committed suicide last night. And you can imagine the shock and the sorrow. And they said, the body will be shipped to the local funeral home and they'll call you when it comes in and you can go down and identify your son. And so they waited, and about a week later the call came that the body had arrived and they made a time to go down and claim the body. And they went down, and when the casket was open, the mother fainted because there lay their son with one eye, one arm, and one leg. Can you receive your prodigal if they have one eye, one arm, and one leg? That may be a decision you'll have to make. But folks, I sympathize with any that have failed in what they consider the most important, one of the most important duties of life, fail with a child. But remember, it's not your total fault. If you can see your faults, confess them. Get forgiveness. But realize that they have a responsibility for their own sins. Hurt as much as it does, much grief as it brings, never stop praying, never stop seeking, never stop looking down the road. Because you never know when that stumbling prodigal might come home. I'm going to give you a little time to think about that before the next bell rings. I've had to be with a lot of sorrowing parents. I've gone to the jail to see them, get them out of jail. And I have cried with them. May God bless you. I ask you again to consider the fault of asking for the prayers of the congregation, because that can help you bring relief to your sorrow. Next week, we're going to be looking at some of the wise sayings of Eural in chapter 20, and then take chapter 21, and where you have presumably Bathsheba's advice to King Lemuel, a symbolic name for Solomon, and then that beautiful description of the worthy woman. Read ahead of time, and so we can discuss and meditate together.